I will try to stay away from this board if I can. Let me use it to write this. So this is, let me write, so this is a joint project, three of us, myself, Romain, Tessera, and Gualian Yu. And I don't think, we had a little mini course in which this was discussed somewhat at the Vanderbilt Spring School. But I don't think there's a huge overlap here, so if, between the audience there and here. So if you were there, there will be some overlap, and I would apologize for that. So I'm going to start. It's motivational. This was something perhaps people know, perhaps not. It's asymptotic convention. Is introduced by Gromov. So this is a property for metric spaces. So we don't have any assumptions on the metric space. In fact, it doesn't even have to be a metric space. It only has to be a pseudo-metric space. It's a general rule. And here's the definition of the asymptotic dimension of the space X is less equal D. D for dimension means that if you're given an R, which is a natural, well, you could say I take it to be a natural number, there's a decomposition of the space X, like in the following way. First, you write the space as a union of D plus one subspaces, and then each one of those subspaces, you have to further write it as a union. And this union here has to be R disjoint, the second union. That, of course, means that if you have a fixed I and two J's, a J not equal to a J prime, the distance between those two sets should be bigger than or equal to R. And if you look at all the subspaces you get, the whole collection, as the I and J vary, it's bounded. So what does it mean, bounded, for a collection? Whenever, if you have a collection of spaces, we apply a property to it to mean that the individual spaces in the collection have the property, but they have it in a uniform way. So for bounded, what that would mean is this. I'll write it up here. That if you take the supremum over all the I and all the J of the diameter of the space, XIJ, that supremum should be finite. So not only is each space bounded, but they're uniformly bounded. So that's the definition. Now, as a general, typically we want to apply these properties of metric spaces like this one, or this property I'm going to define later, the decomposition complexity, not to metric spaces, but to groups, which of course we view as metric spaces. So you take a G, which is going to always be a countable discrete group, and then we always we view it as a metric space, by, well, you could pick left or right invariant, so we'll pick left invariant metric associated to a length function. So L I'll pick an integer valued length function, but it doesn't have to be, is a proper length function. What does proper mean? I guess it's obvious. If you look at any finite subset here, and look at all the group elements whose length lands in that finite subset, it's a finite set of group elements. Okay, so of course the point here is that any two such metrics of this type are going to be coarsely equivalent. It doesn't really matter what coarsely equivalent means if you don't know. And the property of asymptotic dimension and all the properties we talk about today are invariant under coarse equivalence. So if the group has it for one of these metrics, it'll have it for any of these metrics. I'm going to do two or three examples here of asymptotic dimension to warm this thing up, and then I'll switch over to the decomposition complexity. The first example is real. Just in case you've never seen this before. The asymptotic dimension of Z. This is actually equal to 1. But let me explain why it's less or equal to 1 using the definition. I'm guessing there are a few people out there that have never seen this. It's not very difficult. So what does it say, the definition? If I want to show less equal 1, I have to, for every R, break it into two sets, each one of which can be further broken down. Okay, so all you do is you just... So I'm cutting... Like here, this is the distance between the consecutive cutting points is bigger than or equal to R. And I just take every second one, like, color those in. Okay. And the other ones I'll color in with this green-brown color. All right. Okay, so now the union of the purple makes the first set X0. The union of the brown makes X1. Each one is pre-decomposed, so to speak, for you. The brown one is decomposed into a disjoint union of individual brown pieces, any two of which are separated by more than R. Okay, so that means asymptotic dimension less equal 1. Fairly elementary. A bit more to the point, so that's just in case you've never seen it before. A bit more to the point, and perhaps a bit more serious, is this. Supposing I look at the group, a little more complicated. The direct sum from 1 to infinity of Z mod 2. So the asymptotic dimension of this is, perhaps mysteriously, perhaps not, it's 0. So let me try to explain. Well, first of all, I have to have a length function here, so what's the length function going to be? It has to be a proper one like it is in there. So here's a proper length function. Okay, so length of an A, so what's an A? An element in there, it's a sequence. Where each one is either 0 or 1. So I can just add up. Like that. That's a proper length function. Now, why would the asymptotic dimension be 0? Well, supposing I'm given an R, well, I'm not allowed to break up at all for the first decomposition. I have to take the whole thing. So I have to break the whole thing up into R disjoint pieces. So what do I do? Well, I go out, I look at the first R sumands, right? And I take the cosets. My decomposition is going to be the cosets of the subgroup which is given by the first R sumands. Any two of those are more than R apart, because in the R plus first factor here, you have an R plus 1 in this sum, right? So let me just write that down. So it's just like this. So X0i, this collection, or I should use J, which I was using before, is the collection of cosets for the direct sum from 1 up to R of Z mod 2. That does it. I mean, perhaps that's a little disconcerting. And the final example, which is very much an elaboration on the previous one. Well, supposing instead of using Z mod 2, I just use Z. Well, this is not going to have finite asymptotic dimensions, so the asymptotic dimension is going to be infinite. So why is that? Well, so I have the Z to the N, which is a subgroup here. And I didn't say this, but the asymptotic dimension of Z to the N is actually equal to N. And it goes down when you go to a subgroup, the asymptotic dimension does. So this put together gives you that the group we're considering cannot have finite asymptotic dimension. It's not completely, I mean, it's semi-totally obvious here that when you go to a subgroup, if you use the induced metric, the asymptotic dimension goes down. Then you have to invoke this, that the asymptotic dimension is invariant. It doesn't matter which proper metric you use on Z to the N. So you don't have to use the standard one. Use the one that you're getting restricted from here. And then you get this inequality instantaneously. All right. So it's a little bit of a problem. So one thing you can see, you might say, there's a tiny little elaboration on that example. You might say, well, that's really unfortunate, but this group is not finitely generated. But it's no, never mind, because similarly you can show that if you look at the Reith product of Z with Z, so what is that? It's this direct sum, countable direct sum of Z's, then you have to take a semi-direct product by the shift action. That's equal to also plus infinity for the same reasons, but now it's finitely generated. In fact, also for the same reason, because this Reith product group is a subgroup of the group I'm about to write down, the subgroup of matrices generated by these two matrices is also plus infinity. So this is the subgroup of, say, SL2R, because it contains that Reith product. So again, these are finitely generated examples. So that's a bit unfortunate because these are very natural groups to consider, and this infinite direct sum, of course, is a very natural construction to take, a limit. That was a warm-up. So now I'm going to switch over to the decomposition complexity and try to give the idea of the property. Well, so what's the idea? The idea is that we would say, well, we have here some sort of a decomposition which we'd like to axiomatize it. It's a decomposition which says you can break the space up in a certain way into a bounded family. Well, forget the bounded family. Supposing you could break the space up like this and you have some pieces which are really nice pieces. Maybe not bounded family, but maybe nice. Right? Then you might think, well, that's a good enough space to consider. What would it mean for these individual spaces to be nice? Well, maybe you can break them up in the same way. And you can keep breaking the pieces up in the same way until eventually you get to a bounded family. Right? So it's like iterating this particular type of decomposition that you see here in the definition of asymptotic dimension. Okay? So this is how we're going to do this to make it precise. So here in notation, you see, one thing which happens immediately, you see, when I break up one space, I get a collection of spaces, and then I have to break each one of those guys up. So immediately I have to talk about what it means to decompose a family of spaces. So you want to introduce some notation for that so you don't have to carry it around. This is the notation that we use. We use a curly X or a calligraphic X to be a collection of spaces. Only we don't call it collection. We call it family of spaces. And then we say that one family X is DR decomposable over another one, Y, means what? Well, it should mean that for every space in the one space, you can decompose it just like there. For every x in the curly x, there's a decomposition. I'm going to give this a name, this of this kind. Just like that, exactly the same notation, except the family of pieces that you have is not a bounded family. They all have to be from Y. Okay? That's the basic definition. So let's just exercise that definition by making the following remark. That it may or may not be obvious to you what it would mean to say a whole collection of spaces has finite asymptotic dimension. It means they should have asymptotic dimension in a uniform way. Well, what does it mean? You initially might say, well, it means the asymptotic dimension maybe should be less equal d for all the spaces. That's not good enough. Because there's an additional parameter in here which has not really been made explicit, and that's the bound on the resulting family, right? So when you say a collection of spaces has uniformly finite asymptotic dimension, it means they all have asymptotic dimension less equal d, and given the R, you can break each one of them up, and you have a uniform bound here, not only uniform on the I and the J, but also on the individual space X that's being decomposed. So with this notation, we can say that X, a family, has got uniformly finite asymptotic dimension. Uniformly finite asymptotic dimension means that every X in the family, before I make a tiny error here, let me check. Yeah. Means that there exists a D, such that for every R, the family X is DR decomposable over a bounded family. So you might try, if this isn't totally transparent, just try it for one space. If the collection just has one space in it, just write down, just think about what this means, look at that, you'll see it's the same. Okay, so that's the starting point. Now, unfortunately, we're going to... So frequently occasionally I get ridiculed for this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So I'm going to define the finite decomposition complexity property in terms of these kinds of decompositions. And here's the intuitive... The intuition is you start with a family. And now there's just going to be a two-player game, which, as I said, people find this appallingly simple-minded, but I believe it is the best. Having thought about this for quite some time, I believe this is the best way to do it. So you have a player that is supposed, player number one, who's supposed to be the winning player. And then we have player number two, who's supposed to be obstructing the winning of player number one. All right, so this is the way this works. The first player is given the space X, which to start play. And he says, well, he's going to claim that he can D0 decompose the thing appropriately. So he says, I can name that tune in 7 notes, roughly speaking. And then the second player wants to make it difficult. So he says, well, okay, I'd like to see a decomposition. So he will say, well, I'd like to see a decomposition in which we have R1 separated families. Okay. So then the first player has actually to display the decomposition. So he has to, we write it like this. He has to display a new family, Y1, a D0R1 decomposition of X, the D0R1 decomposition of X over Y1. Now you're playing with Y1. So he pauses for a moment and looks at Y1 and says, okay, I believe that I can decompose those into D1 pieces. Now that's the end of that turn. Now the second player, of course, wants to make it tough. So he says, well, I'd like to actually see some decompositions. And so the first player then takes the current family, which is Y1. He says, well, he asserted he could do the D1 decompositions with a D1, so he does it. He gets D1, R2 decompositions over some new family, Y2. And then he looks at the new family Y2 and he says, well, I'm going to use D2 for that. And it continues in this way. It just keeps going. And so it ends, the game ends when the first player reaches a bounded family. First player reaches a bounded family, it's over. Right? And the first player wins. All right, and so what it means for the original family X has got the property finite decomposition complexity. The definition of that is that the first player actually has a winning strategy. That's got a little crazy there. So that means, you know, he doesn't know exactly how it's going to unfold, but he knows that he can't lose. That no matter what challenges he receives from the second player, he's always going to have an answer, and he knows that in some finite number of steps, although it could be quite a large number of steps, he will reach a bounded family. One thing which is potentially painfully obvious is that a space has finite asymptotic dimension means the first player has the winning strategy, which is only going to take one turn. Right? He gives the asymptotic dimension here, and then whatever the second player asserts, he has a decomposition to a bounded family, it's over. So it's a winning strategy that he knows is only going to take one turn. But you could, for example, have groups or metric spaces for which there is a winning strategy, but not of one turn in length. So this one here, this infinite direct sum up to Z, is going to have a two-turn winning strategy. So let me go through that, because it's perhaps a subtle but not so subtle point as to how these, people frequently ask this, how these D's depend on these various R's. Okay, you see that if you do this infinite direct sum of Z's. All right, so let me do that example then out. So we're looking at this infinite direct sum of Z's. Now, the way we discussed it earlier, perhaps it's obvious what's going to happen, right? So, I mean, we can just do this out. I mean, it's not very complicated. And I've already said it, as I said. So, I call it G, although we know it's a metric space. So G, and the first thing is D0 is 0. And then the second player will challenge with some kind of an R. I know this is coming to an end soon, so let me just not write R1, but let me just write R. Then over here, he has to break it up into zero, one piece, and that one piece has to go into R disjoint, further broken down into R disjoint family. So the first breakup here is the cosets for the direct sum from 1 to R of Z, just like we discussed earlier. Okay, so now he's answered the first challenge. And I should say, we're using the same metric we had before. Otherwise, you have to use a different R here than what's here. Now he has to answer back. And he said, well, what's the asymptotic dimension of this thing here? It's a Z to the R. So the asymptotic dimension of it's R. So he's going to say R. Right? And then you note, I should point out, all these cosets, there's really, up to isometry, there's only one space in there, right? So, and it has finite asymptotic dimension R. So then the second player will assert some kind of a thing, something like S, but we know that this space has asymptotic dimension R, so that means we know no matter what S is given, we can break it up appropriately into R plus one pieces, each one of those into an S disjoint and a uniformly bounded family. So over here, we're going to get a uniformly bounded family. And it's over. So I point out again that the D, which was asserted by the first player in the second turn, depends on the R, which was challenged by the second player in the first turn. But the total number of steps is unaffected. It's still going to be 2. All right. So let me say a few words, since some people criticize this thing and many, you know, this intuition here. So I have to formalize this thing correctly, right? So how do you formalize this thing? Well, it's not very difficult to see what's happening, right? So the first player, a winning strategy, he just needs like a tree, a decision tree, which tells him what to do in every possible eventuality, right? So let's just figure it out. So you have a tree, start here, and he's got, let's just do it for this group. So he's got the group here, and he knows he's going to assert 0, right? Now, the second player can have various possible responses. Countably many. They're numbered 1, 2, 3, etc. These are the various R's the second player could challenge. And once the one is given, the first player has to have an answer. Okay? So the answer here would be, as I said, it would be. So let me do a generic one. So this is the R-th one. Then over here we have this family of cosets together with R. That's the labeling here. Right? So then for each one of these, he has to know how to respond no matter what's asserted. And down here, he'll have some sort of a bounded family. Everywhere. Right? So this is what a winning strategy looks like, so to speak, for player number one for this particular group. Now, if you, as I said, you can formalize this completely by saying, well, you should have a tree. I won't write it down because I don't want to waste too much time. I mean, it's not really very difficult to see from here. You have to have a tree, right? And it should be rooted. And then you should direct all the edges so that they point away from the root. And when you do this, every vertex will have, well, that's accountable, the valence has to be countable. So when you do this, at each vertex you'll have one edge pointing in and countably many pointing out. The countably many pointing out, you have to assign each one a natural number, distinct natural numbers, put them in bijection with the natural numbers 1, 2, 3, right? It's kind of the basic structure, and then you have to have it labeled in this way. And of course the critical property is the tree should have no infinite ray. That's the property which is going to guarantee that it's going to be a winning strategy, that you're, no matter what happens, the first player is going to reach a bounded family in some finite number of steps, although you don't know how many. In this case, you know how many, right? But generally, you don't know how many. Okay, so I will write a little. The tree should be infinite valence, countably infinite valence. That's the first thing. And then what do you do? Then rooted. Okay, so then you direct. Perhaps you don't need to do all these steps. Direct away from the root. So then when you're done, each vertex looks like this. You have one thing going in, countably many things coming out. If it's a non, if it's in, well, it has kind of many things coming out of it. It's not a leaf. If it's a leaf, it just has one thing going in. And you have an explicit bijection. Or the out edges. Then second thing is you label. You label in the following way. The label of the root should be your initial the space you start with. When you have an edge, it means that the family labeling one edge has to decompose appropriately over the family labeling the other edge, as in that definition up there. And then there's two more little technical things. So number two, so if you have an edge like this with an R and some Z prime D prime, when this happens, it means that Z has got a DR decompose over Z prime. Three leaves are labeled with bounded families or bi-bounded families. And then big property number three is no infinite ray. So this is one way. One way, there are three ways, actually, to define this class of spaces with finite decomposition complexity. This is one. This is the most intuitive of the three ways, in my opinion. All right, so let me... So 50 minutes, yeah? I'm going to go for 20 more, is that right? Or should I? Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm guessing. So let me say permanence, section two. Okay, so we have this nice property. It looks really great. Okay, so what properties does it have? Well, one of the problems, you see, they asked in some sense, the example that I gave kind of implies almost that this thing is going to be closed under directed unions. That infinite direct sum of Z. And that's an advantage or an advance, so to speak, over finite asymptotic dimension. It's going to get you that Reith product almost, for example. But let me say the fundamental, this is like cultural enrichment, this thing here, right? So there's always a 3.5 properties that you want whenever you have anything. If you're looking at asymptotic dimension, property A, coarse embeddability, no matter what it is, you have to have coarse invariance. That's the first thing. Second thing, you have to have unions. Finite and infinite. Third thing, you have to have a fibering lemma. These three things are for spaces. And if you're just talking about groups, you want to have, it's good to have direct unions. This is just for groups. If you want, this is always what, you always want this. You can arrange it. If your property hasn't got these three things, it's going to be defective. That's just my opinion. But it's an informed opinion. So if you're, so take it seriously. So I'm not going to say, if you want to see, of course invariance is in some level fairly straightforward. Unions in both finite and infinite, I will not say anything about finite and infinite unions here. If you want to see proper formulation, you see, what is patently the case is you can't just say, if you have a space which is a union of countably many subspaces and each one of them has the property, of course the space is not necessarily going to have it. So the infinite union theorem is a little bit subtle in how you phrase it. If you want to see the correct phraseology of that, you look in the paper. I'm going to talk about fibering for a brief moment because I believe that with this particular intuition that I've given here for the property, all those all those four permanent results are easy, and fibring is one that if I get to it, I'm going to use later. So I figured I'll discuss it in a little bit of detail. So I will state a fibring result. So you'll see what's meant by fibring result, and you'll also potentially see how to prove it, at least at the intuitive level. And it will not be the most general fibring result possible. In fact, it will not, I guess it'll be enough for what I'll do later, but it will not be by any, will not be the most general. But it'll be easy to state, so it'll have that advantage, if I can find it. Okay, here's what I mean by fibring. Okay, we have a map. I'm just phrasing it for spaces now. You could phrase it for families if you wanted to. It's a contractive map. Map of metric spaces. The space Y, which is the base, has got finite decomposition complexity. And there's one more sort of critical thing, which is that if you have a family of subspaces, subspaces of Y. Well, there's one obvious thing you can do, right? It's uniform, so it should be bounded. A bounded family of subspaces. You can just take the inverse image of each one. That's now a family of subspaces of X. It has got the finite decomposition complexity property. Then the X has it. That's a fibring result. You see, if one space, you're supposed to think of it, I mean, I've written it horizontally here, but you're supposed to think of it like this. Okay. And so then you've got this one, the base space has got the finite decomposition complexity. And if you break it up into bounded pieces, take the inverse images of those bounded pieces, then that's a collection of subspaces up here. That family should have finite decomposition complexity. And that holds for every bounded family downstairs. Then the whole thing upstairs has finite decomposition complexity. You have analogs of this for, as I said, as I was intimating earlier, for all the properties, for coarse embeddability, property A, all the properties have some sort of variation of this. This is the one which we have, this is for finite decomposition complexity. And the reason I said it was not the most general is this contractiveness, you don't need that. Uniformly expansive would be enough, but I don't want to digress into defining that. Sort of one situation in which you might use this is when if X is a group acting on a space Y, then this map here could be the orbit map. Fix a point in Y, take the orbit. So you can use it to conclude, for example, that a group has got finite decomposition complexity if it acts appropriately on a space that has finite decomposition complexity, which is something that we routinely would want to do. So let me explain how you prove this. Just at the intuitive level. Now, those naysayers who don't like this game are going to particularly not like what I'm about to do. Okay. Can't. I will make a concession to them by not writing proof as if I was about to prove this. All right, this is the idea. That's a tiny concession. Okay, so it's really, really straightforward. So, I mean, perhaps you've already done it mentally, because I have. Okay, so he starts with a space X. Well, he doesn't really know what to do with a space X. But what he does know is, well, I know what to do with a space Y. Let me secretly play with a space Y, but I will not tell my opponent that I'm secretly playing with a space Y. See, Y has got the finite decomposition complexity, so he has a winning strategy there. So he's secretly going to play with Y. He says, well, if I were playing with Y, I would be doing D0. So he says D0. And you get an R1. And he says, well, if I were playing with y, what would I do? I would take y, and I would be decomposing it over some space y1, and I would be giving a d1. Right? Well, let me therefore, since I'm only secretly playing with y, let me decompose x over like the preimage of that family, and still assert d1. So he's only showing decompositions of x, but secretly he's working with decompositions of y. And this will continue for some point, but he has a winning strategy for y, which means at some stage he's going to reach a bounded family. So over here he's going to have something which decomposes over to over the preimage of bounded. Right? But the assumption is that whenever you have a bounded family downstairs and the preimage in x, it has the finite decomposition complexity. So then he's going to say, well, this one I know what to do. I've got a winning strategy for here, so let me start playing with that winning strategy. And that's it. Now you could formalize this in using these trees if you wanted to. But it's basically the idea, right? You play with the base space y until you've exhausted it, you've won down there. Now you start using the pieces and the preimages and you have a winning strategy for that. So then you start playing with those. Fairly convincing. I think that's fairly convincing. Okay. So now you might, for 10 minutes, you might say, well, you know, this looks great. I'm really loving this property. However, I mean, maybe it's really too much. Maybe it's so strong that there aren't any examples, or few. I mean, we've seen that anything with finite asymptotic dimension is an example. We've also seen that this direct sum of countably many z's is an example, but we haven't seen anything more. Well, you would first console yourself by looking at the permanence, and then you'd say, well, if I know about permanence, you can deduce from up there that the property, from what's up there, 1, 2, 3, and 4, you can deduce that it's closed under extensions, for example. You can deduce that it's closed under free products with amalgam, H and N extensions, and all the possible things you could want. They're all deducible in an axiomatic way from those fundamental permanence properties I've given. You still might not be satisfied. So then you might, if you were us, you would consider looking at the linear group case. So this is a theorem, which is a linear group. Remember, every group is countable discrete, so this means a countable subgroup of GLN of some field. A linear group has got finite decomposition complexity. It's a theorem. Okay, so I'm gonna outline or sketch the argument. Let me write another theorem. Although it's a corollary of the first one. It's the one I'm going to sketch the argument for. It's a special case of the first theorem. But it illustrates many of the main points. Supposing that my group is G, which is just GLN of a polynomial ring over the integers 1 indeterminate. This is a countable group. It has finite decomposition complexity. I'm going to prove that. I won't actually be able to prove it in total detail, but I think I can get the fundamental idea out in 7 minutes, which is what I've got. Well, of course, you don't prove a theorem like this from nothing, it seems to me, right? The infinite direct sum of z's, you can just do it. You know, you just sit down and you do it. You have to know a few things to actually prove this theorem. You have to know three things. There are three ingredients. The proving of this theorem, which I'm going to list as proposition 1, proposition 2, and lemma 3. So proposition 1 is that if you look at GLN of C, let me be correct, since I was saying all groups are countable. So a countable subgroup of GLN of C has finite asymptotic dimension, okay, that's, I mean, that looks like I did it already. But I haven't told you what the length function is. When equipped with the length function, so really the left invariant metric associated to this length function, this is not proper, right, which is the whole, I mean, if it were proper, it would be, you know, if you had it for a proper length function, of course, you'd be done. This is decidedly not proper, this length function here. However, it has the advantage of that you can prove this, and it's not too hard. Although this is a well-known thing. Proposition 2. Suppose that K is a countable field, equipped with a discrete norm. Which is denoted like this. Absolute value signs. Then, GLn of K has got finite asymptotic dimension when equipped with the length function so I have a little matrix here, little g is in GLn of K. I'm going to tell you how long it is. Okay, so you look at all the entries of the matrix and you take their norms for this particular discrete norm. And then you do the same thing for the inverse. You take the inverse of the matrix and you take all its entries. Those are G with a superscript IJ. You take their norms. You take the maximum. You take the log of that. That's a length function. All right. So this the first result, I think, is a fairly well-known one. The second result is in MathSense thesis, essentially. Now, if you're a real pro, none of that is probably surprising. The last thing is the only thing which then really, dilemma three, which requires a little bit of effort. You have to think about why it's true. And I kind of like it. I kind of like dilemma three. So let me, therefore, rather than getting it wrong, let me copy it. So I didn't say what a norm on a field is. I'll leave that to your imagination. It's not really crucial. I mean, if I get to it, I will have to use one norm to prove this result here. But I'll just tell you, this is the norm. So G, here we have G is, again, countable discrete. And suppose there exists a length function L prime on G that has got two properties. One, if you take G with the associated metric, it has got finite asymptotic dimension. Two, if you're given an R, there's a new length function, LR on G, such that, again, two things have to happen. One is that with that metric, it has finite asymptotic dimension. These are not proper, these metrics, L prime and LR. You need to relate them somehow to the given proper metric on here. And that's accomplished in this way. For every S, if you look at the intersection of the ball and the LR metric around 1 of radius S, intersect that with the ball radius R, L prime metric, it's finite. This last condition here means that the two metrics, L prime and LR, somehow interact to give a kind of a proper thing on the L prime ball of radius R. Then, the conclusion is then, G has this finite decomposition complexity property. In fact, it has a winning strategy of length 2. Okay. So this is in some ways a glorification of this fibering. Perhaps that's obvious, perhaps that isn't. You see, if the group, let the group act on itself for the D metric, right? Then because the action's transitive, when you're looking at the inverse images of bounded families, you just need to look at the inverse image of one bounded set, namely this ball of radius R in the L prime metric. Right? You want to show that has got finite asymptotic dimension with respect to the restriction of some proper metric on G. And you don't quite get that. I mean, you get it, but it's not totally transparent. What you get is some other metric for which it has finite asymptotic dimension, but which interacts in a proper way on that ball. Right? So it's quite believable. 2 minutes. Or one. And I'm gonna explain how to use these three lemmas, propositions, to prove that theorem. I feel compelled to. Let me stand back for a second, see if I can do it without writing anything on the board in an incomprehensible way that'll take 15 seconds or less. I think I know what I'll do. I'll have to write on the board, but I'll make it homework. But I'll keep all the notations exactly right. So you're going to use this. So you need an L prime metric, right? So the L prime is going to be the length associated to the norm, which is this. The norm of a polynomial is 2 to the degree of the polynomial. Use a little bit of an imagination. I'm only defining it on the polynomial ring. You have to extend it to the field of fractions in the obvious way, but you really only need to know what it is on the polynomial ring for this. And by which I mean associated to, I mean as in proposition 2. So this has got finite asymptotic dimension. That's 1. 2. So now I look at the R ball. We have to think a little bit about how this metric looks and what the R ball looks like. And you notice that the ball matrices with entries in so you look at the metric and you look at it and you say, well, what is it? Well, the one ball is contained in the set of matrices where every polynomial in the matrix has got degree less equal R. So now I need a second metric there, and I'll explain to you how to get that metric. Goes like this. You take R plus 1 transcendentals, get the polynomials into C by evaluation, and then you get, of course, the group G that we're looking at contained in GLN of C. So we're doing this R plus 1 times, and we have a length on GLN of C, which when restricted to a countable subgroup has finite asymptotic dimension. If you add those finitely many lengths together, it has finite asymptotic dimension. And the only thing you have to check is this properness condition number 2, and that's just homework. But it's not hard.